Mini episode 683 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome, everyone, to mini episode number 683 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, and this will be a tremendous conversation that we are bringing your way today. This gentleman, he is one of the most respected Hollywood actors of the last 30 years. We've had him on the program previously, Matthew Bodine. Welcome to the show today. It's a pleasure to have you on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Rick. Nice to be here again.
I was very intrigued once we had the booking for you to come back on. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and find out about what's going on with your career. In terms of this multi-generational perspective here, at what point did you start to get the idea in your head about a project like this? Because, again, you've combined a number of different projects over the years, some of the more mainstream ones with some of the more daring ones that you've kind of done on your own, like Jesus Was a Commie. So at what point in time did it kind of start to register in your head once you saw that the genes had been passed down and that your son had a lot of the same abilities and interests?
Well, he's always wanted to be a director from the time when he was a little boy. He used to love to come to the set and get behind the camera. And somebody asked him at a very early age if he was interested in following in his father's footsteps and being an actor. And he said, no, absolutely not. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I'll be a director. And little did he know at the time that directors get told what to do all the time. And you got to have pretty big shoulders to be a film director. So he and I had been looking for something to do for quite a while. And He was driving this woman, she's kind of, I don't think I should say her name, I'd let him do it, but it's pretty famous, speaking of multi-generational, her father's one of the most famous directors to ever get behind a motion picture camera, and his father was a famous movie star, and is the daughter, so she's an Academy Award-winning actor. And he was to earn some extra money, he's been driving her around. And so it was her birthday, and he called me up, and he said, I'm just sitting out here waiting for her to, finish up her birthday party. Why don't you come by and see me? So I got a couple cups of coffee, and I sat down to talk to him. And he was really frustrated, saying how he really wished that he could find something to direct, something simple, something that would do well and help him, to establish himself as a filmmaker. And I said, well, Bowman, I've got a drawer full of short films that I've written. You want to talk about one of those? And so we talked about Merry Xmas, and if we did make it, who would be the ideal cast for it. And I have a friendship with this actress, Glenn Headley, and that was an easy person because we look like brother and sister. So that was good for that. And then we thought, who would we get to play our father? And Bowman thought that Dick Van Dyke looked like he could be the father of both of us. And I said, well, let's try. And we tried to reach out to his agent. And because it's a short film and no money, no salary, we weren't getting, like anybody that would call up and try to get Dick Van Dyke to be in a film. We didn't get past go. And then I saw that Dick Van Dyke was on Twitter. And so I said, well, let me send him a note, see what he says. And I said, Dick, I've always been a big admirer of yours. I'd love to have the opportunity to work with you one day. And he tweeted me back. He said, I'm not doing anything right now. What have you got? So that led to Bowman and I meeting him and him agreeing to be in the short film. And then we needed somebody who would be really terrific. It's really the hardest part in the film is the mother's role. And it's the smallest part, but it's one of those parts. It's like being a pinch hitter. You got to get up, and everybody's expecting you to hit a home run. And we got Valerie Harper, the lovely Valerie Harper, to come on. And there was a little bit of a 6 degrees of separation there, because Mary Tyler Moore was Dick Van Dyke's wife on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and then Mary Tyler Moore had her show, and
yes.
and Valerie Harper, you know, was they were, and then that turned into Rhoda. So we had Valerie Harper come in and just hit it out of the park for the short film. And just for your listeners, so they know, Mary Xmas is available on iTunes, and it's a really funny, charming movie. And Dick Van Dyke and Valerie Harper and Glenn Headley are adorable in the film.
Oh, absolutely! It is an amazing piece that you guys were able to put together here. And again, when you were writing it, I'll bet you could have scarcely imagined the way it was going to come together here with getting to work on it subsequently with your son and this great casting. I was just blown away when I became aware of this project about the casting. That's amazing how piece by piece you were able to kind of assemble this way, because I think that's probably one of the things that jumps out at people the most is, my gosh, there's a ton of experience and a ton of skill really involved in this from all the major players.
Yeah, well, actors want to work. You know, we want to work and do good quality projects and things that are unusual, things that we've never done before. So it's you won't know unless you ask. I've just directed a new short film with Edward Asner, Kevin Nealon, and Elizabeth Perkins, and my daughter Ruby. It's called Super Sex, and it's an old joke that Eli Wallach told me. And I sent the script to these people. I mean, Kevin and I know each other when I hosted Saturday Night Live, and then Kevin and Elizabeth, we all worked together on Weeds. And Ed Asner, I met playing poker, and I told him I'd love to work with him sometime. And he said, "Well, don't be shy about calling." And so, yeah, so it was. We just shot it last week, and I've got the rough cut of it already. And we're going to be, you know, hopefully getting into the Tribeca Film Festival. I'll send it to them tomorrow.
Oh, that's incredible. And in terms of the recent work you've done, you talk about 6 degrees of separation. There's one more. Ed Asner, Valerie Harper, Mary Tyler Moore, Dick Van Dyke. It all kind of ties together, doesn't it?
There you go.
That really is unbelievable. That sounds like it's going to be a very great work. And, of course, this film itself, Mary Xmas, has been doing well with the awards. Talk about the process of that, how it's gone through.
Yeah, they thought that the short film was going to be a pilot for a series. And Dick Van Dyke suggested it while we were shooting. He said that the family should never actually physically be together. Because in the film, you'll see that we're all talking to each other on the phone. My sister is in China, I'm out in the desert, and Dick Van Dyke is at home, and we're all talking to each other on the phone. And he thought it'd be funny to have a series where the people are never physically in the same space, that they're always having to communicate via telephone or text message or something, you know. And I think it could be an interesting series, you know, if Dick Van Dyke wanted to come play every day.
Oh, that would be amazing. Yeah, it does seem like there's a lot more that could be done with this.
He's just fantastic, by the way. Dick Van Dyke has got more energy than a two-year-old. You just bang two spoons together and make a tune, and he'll start dancing. You know, he'll find a reason to get up out of the chair and start shuffling around. And he's got a beautiful, smart young wife that he's, you know, been with for a few years now. She was a makeup artist, and I don't know if that's how they met, but they're a lovely couple. And it was such a pleasure and honor to work with him.
That's so interesting to hear about him up close. These are the kind of nuggets that I love to get for the show, because you see him from afar, and he does seem like this real ageless kind of a character. But, you know, of course, you never know if that's the way it is in real life or not. But it's fascinating to hear you describe it like that. It sounds like he's a guy that's got a lot of gas left in the tank at this point.
A lot more than most people his age, for sure, yeah.
Wow, that is incredible. But on the younger end of the spectrum here, I wanted to go back to something you said before. It was an observation about Bowman, again, with him doing the directing work on this project here, because it kind of puts me in mind of some of our conversations on the show, speaking with Ben Lyons previously, talking about, having his eyes open to the business from an early age and studying films and really kind of being into things and kind of knowing early on. And you said that he had a very specific kind of direction as far as looking at the directing side of the glass and being on that side of it there. But how much of it would you describe as being a thing where it was really kind of a lifelong process? Did he have an interest in say, older movies and things like that coming up and trying to kind of get a broad spectrum of things that he might like to be involved in?
Yeah, because we didn't have television growing up, you know, with Bowman and Ruby. They went to Rudolf Steiner School, Waldorf schools, and it was discouraged to have television in the house, that it stifled creativity. And one of the things that you do when you don't have that kind of entertainment, you generally start leaning toward books. And Bowman was a prolific reader, and that when he went to school, he studied religion and history. And, you know, knowing that he had that, you know, that he talked about directing films, I thought that was a great background for somebody that was going to study film, because in the religious texts and the historical books that we have such a great picture of the history of humanity and passions, you know, all of the crazy things that happen in the Bible and the Old Testament and then, of course, the reality of that we get from the textbooks, the historical text, that it's full of great stories, and so that I was really happy that took place. But yeah, and then because we didn't have television, we had VHS tapes, you know, so we would rent movies that we really loved, and classical movies and things like that, and he didn't just watch them; he really studied them. He has a good visual and historical storytelling background.
Yeah, very interesting. So there is a lot of commonality then with the kind of picture I'd been painted previously with Ben Lyons, as far as learning that from an early age and studying it. But what I find to be intriguing as well, I picked that up from reading through his blog quite extensively, was about being a very prolific reader as I am, and it's kind of a weird thing, because I was reading it and I was kind of wondering in my head if this is something that he'd ever expressed, because myself, I'm the kind of person, I walk into a bookstore and I get frustrated because there's so many things I want to get and I know I'll never have time to sit down and read everything. Has he ever kind of expressed anything like that with you? I'm wondering how common this is with people who love to read.
Well, he's always loved the fantastical, you know. He science fiction was his passion, and he got involved with Games Workshop, you know, it's like three-dimensional chess, and each of the stories have a backstory. You know, you just don't go in and just play the games with these characters. You have to have an understanding of the history of those characters and what they represent, and so it's funny, but anybody of your listeners that might be listening right now that have ever played that Games Workshop, it's actually, there's a lot of directing that goes on in the playing of the game, you know, the decision making that takes place when you're working on a film set. I mean, it's oftentimes compared to, you know, making movies is like going to battle, which is a gross overstatement. Because there's nothing like actual physically, you know, sending a child or being a person that participates in a war, to say that, you know, to compare that to filmmaking is ridiculous. But there's a reason why they compare it to making films, because you have to have this strategy. You know what the game plan is going to be is to you have a certain number of pages, and you have a certain number of days to film those scenes and get those performances, and then the post production of putting those pieces together, and it is, and there are a lot of battles that get fought, you know, and the one that, you know, all the battles, what you want to do is win the war, which is to make a great picture, and it's difficult. Making movies is a very collaborative medium, you know, where you have to work with so many different kinds of personalities. And, you know, as I mentioned, I just finished this film, Super Sex, and I just showed it to my cinematographer, and he said, you know, he didn't like the last scene. He thinks that it kills the joke. And I've shown it to 10 other people who really love the last bit. So, you know, they say opinions are like belly buttons. Everybody has one, you know. So what you ultimately have to do as a film director is make a decision for what you think is the best way to go. Not necessarily, you can take advice from other people, but you really have to follow your own path.
Absolutely. And I think what you said about battle previously and the way that you framed it is actually very apt, because I think there's a number of us who've probably been through similar situations where you have to strategize and, above all, prepare for what you're doing and really kind of develop a strong plan there. The amount of planning that must go into directing, the amount of preparation for any of these projects really is probably, I would guess, unthinkable to those of us on the outside.
You know, people are always flabbergasted at how much work it takes to get a moment on film. You know, they thought, I thought you just, you know, shoot it, bang, 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 and it's done. But there's sound that's involved. There's a truck that goes by and spoils a shot. You don't get the light right, and you got to adjust the lights, and the focus puller has to pull the focus at the right moment and make sure that things are sharp. The actors, so pulling all those elements together, I think of it as when you take a magnifying glass and you try to focus the sun through that piece of glass so that you can make something burn, make something white hot. That's all that preparation is, like bringing that all to a focus. So that moment when we're standing on the set and we say action, you've made everything come to a focus, and you've got something that's brilliantly white hot, and you try to capture that. You try to capture that heat, and it's hard. It's hard because there's so many moving parts.
I can imagine, yes. There's an awful lot, and the preparation that comes into it. But again, from all of that, the very seed of it being creativity and the talent involved there. And that's what I want to ask you about with, again, your most recent project here, this short film, Super Sex. You mentioned your daughter's involvement with it, Ruby, and I'm very, very interested to get your perspective on this in terms of her musical background and what she's doing. She's really, really doing some interesting genre kind of bending stuff right now. How would you sort of best put it into words as far as the type of music that she makes? Because I couldn't really kind of get words for it myself. It seems to go across a few different genres.
Yeah, in the past she sang a lot of covers. You know, she did As Tears Go by the Rolling Stones and Smile, Smile Though Your Heart Is Aching. Smile. She did a song that Anne Margaret made famous, I Just Don't Understand. But then she saw this Amy Winehouse documentary, and Amy is somebody that when she was a young girl, she loved Amy Winehouse, and the way she sang, it was so original, such a classic, a new classic singer. And so she saw this documentary about Amy Winehouse, and she said that's it. I'm not gonna cover any more songs. Every song that I do is gonna be original. I'm gonna write and score it. And this new batch of songs that she's done, particularly 1905, which a wonderful filmmaker, director, artist made the music video for, called 1905, is just a beautiful song. Pitter Patter Flutter Love is a beautiful song. It's a really romantic song that she's done. I know that she feels that Amy Winehouse is a big influence for her and her music. These songs are available on iTunes, and the music videos are on YouTube, so you can see them. She's trying to figure out how to get them on iTunes. Did I say iTunes? No, I meant SoundCloud.
SoundCloud, okay.
And YouTube. Yeah, the Ruby Modine, and you can hear the songs as if you want to get a sense of the songs that we're talking about, but they're all there, and you can hear her voice. I think that she's amazing. They offered her a slot on The Voice this next session that's coming up on the television show The Voice, and she made a decision that her acting career was the direction that she wanted to go, and that she felt that she could go back to the music, but she really wants to focus on being an actor right now. And I love her music. So, but if her passion is being an actor, well, I certainly understand that after having done it for almost 40 years. So I'm not going to discourage her from following her passion.
Absolutely. And again, one of the commonalities really between the two businesses is that there's a lot of times where the influence of someone who is really a giant can live on through somebody else, whether the other person was a protege of theirs or whatever the case may be. That's a pretty cool thing that you mentioned about Amy Winehouse, because if you sort of look at it a certain way, that's part of the legacy of Amy Winehouse, is that she's inspiring young singer-songwriters, it's still to this day, to keep on doing that. So even if it's not her main thing that she's doing right now, it's really interesting how that sort of plays into the larger mosaic of the story of Amy Winehouse.
Yes, it's true. Yeah. She said when she goes in the recording studio, she kind of says a little prayer to Amy, and she feels that Amy's there in the booth, the recording booth with her.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. That really is. And it's very, very inspiring as far as how people can take what really they admire from others and use it to be applied in new directions. But again, a tremendous part of your legacy here with your career, as far as, again, the creativity that you have passed down in different directions here, whether it be your daughter with the acting or singing, your son behind the camera, just to kind of bring this full circle. I mean, how does that make you feel, both as a father and in terms of whatever your legacy is, to know that you've passed down this creativity and that it's going to be played out for the next several decades to come?
Well, everybody will say this, that what they want their children to be is happy and productive and, do things that make them feel fulfilled. So, it's very exciting to know that my children are number one, happy and pursuing goals that make them happy. That's the most important thing. The good news is that they're both very good at what they do. I think that, when you have a father or mother that's in the industry, or also in politics, probably in a lot of things, that if you do something very well, and the child is coming up and trying to, do something similar, there's great expectations, that audiences or people will have for the children. I mean, imagine bringing Frank Sinatra's son or daughter, and so you got Nancy Sinatra and Frank Sinatra Jr. Frank Sinatra Jr. is an amazing singer. He tours to this day. Nancy Sinatra, I don't know if she still sings. I know she's got a radio show that she does. But the expectations that audiences have, it's so easy to say, oh well, he doesn't sing as good as his dad. Well, does he sing good, and does he sing differently? How do they perform? Is Walter Houston better than John Houston? Is John Houston better than Angelica Houston? What you want to do is just do your best. There's a book that the author Henry Miller wrote called Paint for Yourself and Die Happy, and I think it's really good advice. Is that what you really have to do is do your best and don't worry about everybody else, because people are going to have, as I said before, opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone's going to have one. And you just, you have to do what makes you happy. You hope that other people will enjoy it and find pleasure in the things that you do and create. But you probably feel that way with this radio show that you run, that there's going to be a lot of people who could tell you how they think that you could do it better, but you're doing it the way that you want to, and you take the advice that's helpful, and you toss the other stuff out with the dirty bathwater.
Absolutely, that's great insight, actually, because again, a show that tries to be nothing is off topic, like us trying to go broad all over the place, that's not for everybody, and sometimes people have a hard time wrapping their heads around it. But you're absolutely right. Everybody's got to do things the way they got to do them. And as far as what you said about Frank Sinatra Jr., the last time I checked, not as good a singer as Frank Sinatra is not exactly a put-down, of the people you're going to be compared to. There's a lot of people that are very famous and very successful that are not nearly as good singers as Frank Sinatra, but are very successful by any standard. So, absolutely, the prism by which the world views people who are second or third generation is always very interesting. And along those lines, we definitely look forward to get a chance to talk to your son here subsequently on the show, as well as your daughter, with or without you, depending on how the schedules line up. So please pass that along. I know that they have some very interesting stories to tell, and we are all about interesting stories here. And again, you have furnished us with a great many of them here today, as well as your two previous appearances. So I thank you so much for your time, Matthew. You have a great day.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. And thank you all, everybody, for joining us for FDH Lounge mini-episode number 683.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.